Good morning.
Good morning to the court. I'm Catherine Mayer with the law firm Carter & English.
Could you talk into the mic?
Oh, I'm sorry. Good morning. Catherine Mayer with the law firm of McCarter & English. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant Texaco, Inc. I am pleased to introduce you my co-counsel, who is here with me as well, Eric Wishman, who is trial counsel and is also with McCarter & English. And I also am pleased to introduce MC Sangala, who is with the law firm of Horvitz & Levy out in California. And she's here today to present on behalf of Texaco, Inc., with the court's permission. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to focus my presentation on issue number one in our opening brief, that is, the lack of any admissible or legally sufficient evidence to quantify exposure. Indeed, to quote the trial court, the element of exposure and its quantification is really the nub of this case. Establishing causation in a toxic tort case or in a complex tort case requires expert testimony, as this court has acknowledged in Money v. Manville. And proving exposure requires more than just establishing the presence of benzene in a plaintiff's workplace. There's also a requirement of a sufficient level of exposure to have been able to cause the type of harm that the plaintiff claims, that is, a sufficient, legally sufficient level of exposure and dose. Here we have the plaintiff presenting one expert to quantify exposure. That expert was Dr. Mark Nikas. He said that he did not have enough information, that is, he didn't know how many pumps there were or the percentage concentration of benzene in any other area of the reformer or of the refinery other than the reformer area. Therefore, he limited his quantification to the reformer area. What was that calculation based on? It was based entirely on the words of two coworkers about the number of pumps there and their thought that those pumps had 100% benzene in them. In fact, the two coworkers never testified to the number of pumps or the percentage of benzene on direct. On cross-examination, they asserted there was 100% benzene in the reformer area, and mainly they said that because, hey, that's where benzene was made.
Does that matter whether it came out on direct or cross?
Well, to the extent that plaintiff's counsel is urging that this is a weight issue, I'm merely emphasizing that it is not a weight issue. It's not a case of a witness on direct saying one fact and then injecting some doubt about that on cross-examination. This is a situation where what they said at almost exactly the same time they said it, they're admitting is an assumption, that they have no foundation for it. This isn't a question of weight. It's a question of admissibility and a total lack of evidence. This is somewhat akin to, say, a personal injury case where someone says that the light was red and the defendant crossed it, and I know that light was red, and that's a pivotal fact or point in the case. When in fact you find out the witness wasn't even looking at the light, and so the witness doesn't really know it was red. That's pretty much the situation here. We have the workers assuming that it was 100% benzene because benzene was made in that area. In fact, as the testimony came out at trial, the way benzene is made is that it is extracted from other chemicals, and therefore this assumption that it was 100% everywhere in that area was demonstrably false as well. So that's really it. You've got the two coworkers, and they're saying at the same time that they're quantifying that it is an assumption. And the plaintiff's own expert, Dr. Nikas, says, my calculations depend on the number of pumps and the percentage concentration. If I either don't know that or don't have that information, I cannot quantify. That's essentially what he said about the other areas of the plant. And without the coworkers, he doesn't have that information for the reformer area either, and therefore there's no quantification. And this is not an asbestos case. Quantification definitely matters, as both experts agreed at trial, both plaintiff's experts and defense experts agreed that there's a certain dose that you need to have before there's a possibility of harm.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, what could Dr. Nikas have done to get more reliable underlying information upon which to base his opinion?
Well, actually, there was air monitoring data of not of the types of work type of workers that Mr. Gates was, but of other workers at the plant. And that was data that was provided in discovery to plaintiff's counsel, and it was data on which defense experts relied in their quantification estimates.
Right, but I assume that that data was not particularly helpful for plaintiffs, was it?
No, it wasn't.
Right.
No, it showed levels lower.
If an expert wanted to base his conclusion on the amount of benzene that was in the tanks and the level of actual exposure to it, how would he get that information other than to ask people who were there, what was it, 20 years ago, were in a position to know what was going on because they worked there?
Well, those are possibilities. There's the data that the experts could rely on. There's also coworker testimony. I'm not saying that you can never rely on coworker testimony. You just need to rely on coworkers who know what the heck is going on. These coworkers did not. They did not have the basis for information that the expert needed to provide the estimates.
All right. The other question I had, at least at the moment, is wasn't there some report that indicated it was at least 71% benzene overall as opposed to 100% and that 71% is still a toxic level?
I'm glad you asked that question because I'm really, really pleased to unpack that for the court. In fact, the report, which was never admitted in evidence, said anything about 71%. It did not have a 71% number in it. The 71% number came from a suggestion, and that is the phrase that was used. If I suggest to you, Mr. Expert Witness, that there's a 71% average weighted calculation here, what do you think of that? And that was in cross-examination of our quantification expert, Dr. Spencer.
So you're saying that this report did not provide a basis for concluding that 71% was the average or overall percentage of benzene?
What I'm saying is the 71% number came from plaintiff's counsel's mouth.
I understand.
I'm sorry?
From plaintiff counsel's mouth, and statements by counsel are not evidence.
What I'm asking is whether the report did or did not indicate a 71% level of benzene.
It did not have a 71% number in it. There were statements from it, or there were numbers read from it from plaintiff's counsel with sort of smattering of, oh, here's a 95%, here's a 12%, here's a 9%. But there was no quantification of 71% in the report. And this is unfortunately not the kind of thing that you or I or anyone who isn't an expert can just start throwing numbers around and using them to quantify exposure. This is a scientific inquiry that requires expert testimony and expert analysis. So I applaud plaintiff's counsel for wading into the math arena, but it wasn't for him to do, and the jury needed an expert witness in order to quantify that.
Was that argued to the jury, that the 71% was bogus?
The plaintiff's counsel certainly emphasized the 71% and the EPA report. In fact, it urged the jury to rely solely on a report that was never in evidence and the 71% number in order to find for the plaintiff.
But did the defense argue to the jury that 71% was pulled out of the air and was not reliable?
I don't know that it was characterized exactly that way. I can't say that it was characterized exactly that way. I'd be happy to check that and report back on rebuttal.
Counsel, can you talk into the mic, perhaps if
okay.
It's difficult to hear you.
Okay, is that better? Perfect. Okay. So the EPA document is one of the items that plaintiff's counsel points to kind of fill in this evidentiary gap that's left by Dr. Nikas's testimony. There are a couple of other items.
Let me interrupt you again.
Mm-hmm, sure.
In terms of the EPA document, was there any discussion about introducing it into evidence and any objection to it, or it was just there was no effort to ever introduce it and no objection to it?
There was no effort by plaintiff's counsel to actually introduce the document. There were a couple of other.
Take it, nor was there any application to bar plaintiff's counsel from referring to the document without admitting it into evidence.
No, there were objections to that in closing to reference to the document in closing.
What about during the examination of the witness?
No, not during the examination. There are three other efforts by plaintiff's counsel to kind of fill in this evidentiary gap, as I mentioned. One of them is to pull out a third coworker. That's Peter Scarmazzi, another millwright. This is a millwright on whose testimony their quantification expert, Dr. Nikas, expressly did not rely. So he really doesn't form the foundation for the expert's opinion, but even assuming that the expert did rely on him, he doesn't really help the quantification question either. He just says, hey, you know, benzene was in the area. Benzene was in the reformer area. We used it. He at the most establishes that the presence of benzene and exposure generally to benzene, but that's not the question here. The key question here is quantification of that exposure and was there enough to cause plaintiff's harm. So he doesn't help fill that gap either. There were two other medical experts, Dr. Infante and Goldstein, who plaintiff presented. Neither one was technically a quantification expert. They were general causation experts. But they nonetheless offered some opinion about causation in Mr. Gates' case. But each of their opinions in that regard falls for the very same reason that Nikas's opinion falls, which is they relied again on either Nikas or the two coworkers. So those levels of exposure, again, are completely dependent on the facts that Nikas relied on, which turned out to not be facts at all. That is, particularly the percentage of benzene and concentration in the area.
So the sum total of your argument, if I characterize it correctly, is that there was no reliable evidentiary foundation for the expert's conclusion, and therefore the expert should not have been allowed to testify about it.
Absolutely. And that's really all I have at this point. I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. John Spadaro for the plaintiff appellee, Connie Gates. Your Honors, if I could begin, I guess this logically is the beginning, because on this Daubert issue with respect to Dr. Nikas's testimony, there's a dispute as to standard of review. So if it's helpful, I'd just like to note that the standard of review is not de novo, as Texaco contends, but abuse of discretion. Whenever a trial court either admits or excludes expert testimony, it's discretionary and it's subject to an abuse of discretion standard. The fact that that ruling on the admissibility of expert testimony might be incorporated into a dispositive motion, or indeed even be the fulcrum of a dispositive motion, does not change the standard of review from abuse of discretion to de novo, and for that we rely on the Ninth Circuit's decisions in the McKendall and Lust cases, which we cited.
If in fact there was no evidentiary foundation for the testimony of the expert, on the issue of exposure, wouldn't that be an abuse of discretion?
It would, Your Honor. Of course, our position is that we're not remotely in that ballpark. But, yes, that, to allow an expert to testify without foundation would satisfy either standard. As to causation, I think a question that Texaco has hit upon, which is an important question here, is how is causation proven in an exposure case? And Texaco never really says what you have to do. They seem to suggest that it's mathematical precision, that it's laboratory precision. At Texaco's opening brief at page 21, they twice cite the Parker v. Mobil Oil case, which is a decision of New York's highest court, where that court said that precise quantification is not necessary in an exposure case. And this court, in the Strute case, has held that causation need not be established with laboratory precision. Texaco also cites, and this is a very useful case, the Eighth Circuit's decision in Wright v. Willamette Industries, where once again the Eighth Circuit says that we're not going to require a precise table comparing levels of exposure with levels of harm. So I think that settles what we don't have to show. I guess the more important question is, what do we have to show? And I thought it might be helpful if someone finally stepped forward and said what that is. And that's from the Wright case on which Texaco relies, where the Eighth Circuit said, and if I could be forgiven for quoting here, there must be evidence from which a reasonable person could conclude that a defendant's emission has probably caused a particular plaintiff the kind of harm of which he or she complains. Probably caused.
Well, let me stop you there, because yes, I don't think that's really what is at issue here, unless I'm misunderstanding. The problem, if there is one, is that your expert reached a conclusion based upon co-workers saying there was 100% benzene in the tanks, and it, you know, the people were exposed to it a certain amount of actual benzene every day or whatever. And then when they were asked, how did you know that, they said, we don't know, we just assumed it. I mean, is that pretty much an accurate statement of what they said, and then when they were, you know, questioned about it, what the basis for them saying it was?
Your Honor, I don't believe it is.
Well, help me then.
Sure. Moving on from the fact that the standard is more likely than not, I think Your Honor has correctly paraphrased what Texaco contends is the import of that testimony. But, and of course, the word assumption came up in the testimony. I wouldn't deny it. But the clear import of the Millwright's testimony is more nuanced. And since we're talking about an historical base that lasts for many years, it's more complicated than that, as it often is. The clear import is that their understanding through long years of experience at the reformer unit and at the Millwright shop, not just the reformer unit. I think counsel said that Dr. Nikas relied only on the reformer unit. It may be a matter of semantics, whether you're considering the Millwright shop part of the reformer area. But the Millwright shop is an important part of this equation, where there was specific testimony about spillage of benzene on tables and the dipping of hands into tanks filled with benzenes and trichloroethylene. But the import is that through these long years of experience in these areas, that the duties of the millwright daily involved substantial exposure to benzene, both in the reformer unit and the millwright shop. And more specifically, this is what they said. They conveyed to the jury that the pumps in the reformer unit were heavily laden with benzene, and that they thought it was 100% benzene, and some of them said, well, if it wasn't 100%, it sure was close. That's okay. The kind of testimony
okay,
they gave.
Well, wait a second. How does somebody know, how does anybody know, other than by actually doing some sort of laboratory test, what percentage of benzene there is in some solution?
Well, you can't intuit the precise percentage of benzene in a length of pipe by staring at the pipe. You've got to take the benzene out and do laboratory analysis. So is the standard that you have to show, if that's the standard, then we turn the case law on its head, and it has to be precise laboratory precision, which this court has said it isn't. But
that wasn't my question. My question was, you've got coworkers who are there for a long time, know what's going on, you know, basically would appear to be competent to
sure.
testify about what was and wasn't happening. When it comes to things like spillage and whether people put their hands in it and things like that, fine. But with respect to what the percentage level of benzene was in those pipes, or tanks, they said 100%. And they said, when they were asked, you know, they said, well, that's what we assumed. And if it wasn't 100%, it was a lot. On what do they base that assumption? Because if it's based upon facts, that's one thing.
Sure.
If it's based upon, you know, just we figured that's what they were doing when it could have been 50% benzene, then that's a different story.
And of course, we have the NESHAP study, which I'll get to, but suppose we didn't have the NESHAP study. They can't, again, they can't intuit what the percentage is. The question is, how do they know? Well, they know from common experience. They've worked there for 10, 20, 30 years. They know that it's common knowledge among all the millwrights. The jury knows from the industrial hygienist on the other side, Mr. Spencer, who testified for Texaco and said that the very purpose of the reforming unit is to, quote, basically extract or make pure benzene. The very purpose, according to Texaco, of the reforming unit is to make pure benzene. So logically, you're going to find a lot of benzene. Now, whether it's going to be 100% in each line or valve or 95%, and the EPA found many that were 95%, not 100. The finding ultimately is at 71% time-weighted average.
Okay, but, well, help me, because I don't know much about benzene, okay?
Nor do I, sad to say, Your Honor.
If but, it's liquid, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so it's in a great big bucket. If you're somebody who works with benzene all the time and you look at that bucket, can you tell how concentrated it is from what it looks like or the way it swishes around or something like that?
No, it's odorless, and you can't tell whether it's 12% benzene in the bucket or 100% benzene in the bucket. But suppose you have a job for 20 years where they say your job is to empty the benzene bucket every day, and you work at it for 20 years. Are you competent to testify to a jury, this was a bucket full of benzene? And it was understood that every day I was emptying a bucket full of benzene. I'm not a chemist, and I don't do laboratory analyses. In the same way, and we use some of these analogies in our brief, when I fill my gas tank up with gas, I assume that the gas pump has gas in it because it's our common experience. And we put the gas in the car, and the car runs, so it appears that we were right, there's gas in there. I don't know the percentage. They tell me what the octane is. I don't know. They tell me it's gasoline. I don't know. But it's a common understanding, and I think I'm competent to testify that every single time I've ever gassed up at a gas pump, even if I did it 5 minutes before coming to court and I haven't driven my car yet, I'm competent to testify that I put gas in my car. And the jury can say, I don't know because I haven't done the test.
Let's get at the question a little differently.
Sure, Your Honor.
Does the record disclose whether or not there is a threshold level that needs to be exceeded in order for exposure to benzene to be toxic?
I believe that Texaco made a showing, and I want to use the right vernacular, that if you're below 45 parts per million,
okay,
you're
the
okay.
It doesn't mean yes, it's 45 parts per million roughly, right?
For lay purposes, I think a scientist might say, well, you could.
Is that yes or no?
It's just qualified yes, because you could contract leukemia at less than 45, but you're okay with OSHA. So
okay.
I think, yes, for lawyers' purposes and judges' purposes, yes, it's 45.
Okay. Keep your answer short because we're short of time.
I understand, Your Honor.
Does the record show anywhere that threshold was exceeded?
Yes, in two respects. The NESHAP study, which was not as a document entered into evidence.
Why is that?
Well, you know, I didn't try the case. And we could say, you know, we could only say, well, it would have been preferable if they admitted it. There might have been strategic reasons for not admitting it. There might be content in a document that's helpful and then content that's hurtful, and both sides are wary of the document.
So you don't know.
So I don't know exactly why it wasn't, but it doesn't need to be, obviously, because testimony is evidence. And what counsel said, and I think there was some liberties taken with what was actually asked and answered. I can move away from the podium for a minute. If you look at page B214 and 215 of our appendix, you see that their expert, Mr. Spencer, is shown the report, and he's asked, you know, question after question. You see on this page they found 95% benzene in this valve and 95% in this pump, and so on and so forth. Page after page, question after question, yes, yes, yes. Then the calculation is done. The simply a matter of objective math at the time. You know, if counsel says, if I suggested to you that calculated weighted average is 71%, you have any reason to disagree with that? And so Mr. Spencer was given an opportunity to disagree, and he didn't, because that's the math. The fact that the number 71 isn't in the report doesn't change that you can actually average out.
And how was that number arrived
at? It was arrived at simply by, you know, by doing an average, you know, adding and dividing to arrive at the average.
Percentage for the each pump, averaging what that is?
And Your Honor, I'm not an expert in how you arrive at time-weighted averages, but the industrial hygienist is. And he's asked, do you challenge – we did the calculation. Do you challenge that calculation? And he doesn't challenge it. The jury is free to – you know, the obvious inference is that's a correct number, because if it wasn't, he would reject.
Was there a motion by the other side to strike that testimony?
Well, in their post-trial motion, they do say that he shouldn't have been allowed – to refer to the NESHAP study because
it was post-trial, but not during the trial.
No, not during the trial. There was not a contemporaneous objection made to that testimony. But Your Honors,
but that was in defendant's case, right?
That was on cross-examination by the plaintiff during defendant's case in chief. That's right.
So if a motion for a directed verdict were granted at the end of plaintiff's case, nothing about that study would be before the court, would it?
Well, that's true. What we did in the case in chief is that we had Dr. Nikas on the stand, and we said, assume hypothetically a finding of 71% weighted average of benzene in the reformers' lines and pumps. And he said, well, if you assume that, then the number is 167 parts per million years, which far exceeds the 45 million part per million years threshold. Based on the – but remember, we did have in our case in chief the testimony of the millwrights, and we had a calculation based on that which was even higher, which was 291 parts per million years.
Now they, and what was that 291 calculation based on?
Dr. Nikas did two scenarios. Based on what the millwright said about we do this, a gallon would spill, we do that, a gallon would spill, he came out with 291 parts per million years. Based on the assumption of a 71% time-weighted average, which was an abstraction at the time he testified, he came out with 167 parts per million years. And then later in the case, we tied that abstraction to the actual NESHAP finding because Mr. Spencer agreed to what page after page what it said and did not challenge the math and the 71% time-weighted average.
But you didn't tie that to the 71% during your own case, did you?
No, we didn't. In the case in chief, we relied the other shoe to drop.
Wait a second.
Yes.
How do you present evidence to a jury that is based, you know, please assume 71%, and then you get through with your case and you rest and you've never tied that 71% to anything? How does that become evidence that a jury should consider?
Because there are two scenarios. And, of course, the trial didn't end there.
I'm talking about the 71%,
right,
and I'm talking about at the end of your case. I'm not talking about when the trial ended.
We hadn't proved causation through that second scenario, the 71% scenario, by the close of plaintiff's case. We had made the prima facie case on causation in the case in chief through the first scenario, where we had Mr. Scarmozzi testifying about the conditions, about the ubiquity of, you know, the really Dickensian conditions in the millwright shop. We had Mr. Roach and Mr. Laxton.
But wouldn't you agree that if that were presented to the court at the end of your case, the court would be correct in saying, well, I'm not going to consider the 71% testimony because you haven't tied that to anything?
At the close of the plaintiff's case, yes.
Okay.
Because it wasn't tied in until their case in chief. However, it would not have been appropriate to grant judgment as a matter of law at the close of the plaintiff's case in chief because the millwrights had provided a basis. Now, they say it's shaky.
Okay, so you're saying there was enough evidence even without tying together the number to the EPA report. Was there a motion for directed verdict at the close of the plaintiff's case?
I believe there was, yes, Your Honor. And, of course, I believe it was argued at that point that, you know, the millwrights don't cut it. They haven't given him a threshold foundation. But rules, the advisory committee notes to Rule 702 are so helpful on this appeal, and they say very clearly that it's not the province, the requirement of sufficient facts and data, it does not authorize trial courts to embrace one side's version of the facts against the others. And we cited Bear with me just for a second, Your Honor.
What are we talking about here when you say one side's version of the facts against the other? The credibility of the co-worker's testimony?
Yes. They're saying that if you can get the co-worker to say, how do I know? Well, I've always assumed that. It's always been my understanding that it completely wipes out the reliability of all their testimony.
Okay, so that was a question for the jury.
We're saying it was a question for the jury. And the word, I think we, you know, people speak colloquially, we're dealing with millwrights. And the word assumption, there's an awful lot of weight put to bear on the word assumption in this case. The millwrights did not say, I have no idea whether there's benzene in the reformer unit. I'm just guessing. These are people who worked there for decades.
Did you attempt to rehabilitate your witnesses and have them establish that when I said assumption, I didn't mean I was just making it up. It was based upon knowing A, B, or C?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that's a judgment call because I don't know how effective that'll be with a jury, and it underscores the word assumption for them. So strategically, you may not want to do that. But
I'm just asking whether you did.
I don't remember anything in the record where we went back and redirect and said, well, by assumption, what you mean it's your understanding or trying to – and frankly, we don't think it needed much rehabilitation because you read the testimony – instead of one line where they use the word assumption, if you read the testimony as a whole, it's a very compelling story of a very dirty and dangerous workplace where there's benzene spilling all over the place all the time. And, of course, we had the NESHAP study ready to go in their case in chief as well.
In the reformer unit, can you just – give a simplistic discussion of how benzene is made, what goes in, what happens, and what comes out, and are these pumps at the exit point of the reformer unit process? In other words, is it all the benzene, pure benzene, always in there? Or not?
Well, I don't know if I can satisfy Your Honor too much to the science of it, but it's not even though their expert talks about making benzene because it's so ubiquitous, you actually extract the benzene from the oil. And the pumps are heavily laden with benzene. But how much benzene? That's the important question. The NESHAP study shows that because they selected 20 pumps.
But the question is at what point or what stage in the process did the benzene, whatever percentage it might have been, get into the pump?
I can't pretend to know the process well enough to tell Your Honor that. But it's at a stage where the millwrights are asked to, when the pumps have to be worked on, that they actually pull the pumps, so-called. They remove the pumps, and they open the valve. And the millwrights tell us that the product would spray, the benzene would spray out and soak them.
It seems implicit that these pumps are post-extraction. Is that right?
I don't know, Your Honor. I honestly don't. Well, I'm getting some nods from the peanut gallery that knows better. So it appears that they are. Yes, sir. We cited it. This is an important case because it's right on point. In the microchemical case in the Federal Circuit, the defendant sought to exclude an expert's testimony because he, quote, based his opinion on inaccurate facts. And the Federal Circuit said that the defendants, and forgive me another quote, end up complaining that the experts, and here they use the expert's name, the expert's testimony was not based on reliable facts, which is exactly what's being argued here. The court held that the integrity of the facts was a jury question. They said, when the party's experts rely on conflicting sets of facts, the jury can decide. Did they score a debating point with these millwrights when they used the word assumption? I'm sure they did. The jury was not impressed with it because these folks were able to say, when there'd be a half a gallon spilled in this operation. There'd be a gallon spilled in this operation. We did this so many times a day. In an average week, we did it this much. And Dr. Nikas was able to employ the methodology from that. This is not a methodology case. They've admitted that their industrial hygienist used the exact same methodology that we did.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Just a couple of points I wanted to respond to. I really appreciate that the counsel admitted that they weren't a time-weighted average expert, and neither was the counsel who tried the case.
I can barely hear you. Would you talk louder?
Okay. I appreciate that plaintiff's counsel on appeal admitted that they're not a time-weighted average calculation expert because neither was their trial counsel, and that was the only place from which the 71% calculation came from.
Well, didn't your opponent just say the industrial hygienist had the opportunity to disagree with 71% and he did not?
Well, I'd like to really get in depth about how that came about in the cross-examination and the context for that statement. In fact, plaintiff's counsel didn't really explain the entire answer that the industrial hygienist responded with to that question, nor did he point out that the entire line of questioning with regard to the EPA document, the industrial hygienist at the outset said, I have never seen this report. I do not think it is relevant to personal workplace exposures. It's an environmental assessment. I didn't look at it. I didn't rely on it. And I don't think it's relevant here. This is the first time I'm looking at it. When you tell me it says that number, yeah, it says that number. But I do not think that it applies here, and I cannot tell where that pump is in the extraction process, whether it's further down the line or earlier in the line, which has an impact on the percentage of benzene in it. And I also appreciate that plaintiff's counsel is asserting that that all of these pumps that were dealt with by these millwrights were somehow clearly post-extraction. Post-extraction was in an area called the Tetra unit, and in fact there's no evidence that Mr. Gates worked in that part of the reformer section.
Okay, so the expert said, I've never seen this before, I'm not vouching as to its reliability. I don't know what this is all about. At that point, did counsel for Texaco jump up and say, Your Honor, we asked the court, we object to this whole line of questioning and asked the court to instruct counsel not to question the witness about this document?
No, there was no objection with regard to the questioning. And the full response to the 71% question by the expert was, again, I don't think this report is relevant. I'll take your number at what you're telling me, that I guess, you know, that's the number you're telling me, but I haven't done a calculation. I don't know.
Okay, so the court was not asked to rule as a matter of law that those questions were improper. And so they, at that stage, they were properly before the jury, correct?
That's right, that at that point they were not, but it still doesn't create evidence to support the plaintiff's case. Let's see. The other point I wanted to respond to was the quantification and mathematical precision point. As I said in my opening, that it is perfectly acceptable to rely on coworker testimony and not explicitly quantified, but in this case, we have an expert who says it's very important to a calculation of dose to know exactly how many pumps there were and what concentration there was. So according to plaintiff's own expert, that's important in this particular case. And with regard to a standard for exposure, some kind of test that people can follow in quantifying it, we did cite several cases in footnote 1 of our reply brief, which do talk about that the standard, a proof of that you need more than mere frequency, regularity, and proximity. While that's necessary, it's not sufficient, as it provides none of the quantitative information necessary to support causation. And that's where the case falls down here, is in the quantification realm.
Let me just ask you a little bit about that, because if I understand correctly, plaintiff's expert said it was 200 million or whatever parts per million, and that if it were at 71%, it would be 140 million, and the magic number, if you will, is 41 parts per million. So if the jury is hearing that, well, if it were 100%, then you would be four times above the limit, and if it were 71%, you would still be more than three times above the limit, doesn't that give, can't the jury extrapolate from that even if we're off even more, this person was way above, his level of exposure was way above the acceptable limit?
Well, it's not enough to find causation on speculation, and that's essentially what you're asking the jury to do in that regard. Somewhere in between is hey, it's a number. In fact, there was evidence that Nikas was asked about, if you worked on less pumps or there was a 10% concentration of benzene instead of 100%, what would your estimate be? Well, that would be 0.29 ppm years. So there's another number from Nikas with a different factual assumption that's much lower, which indicates it would be well below the 45 ppm year limit. And that's at A1206 in the record.
I'm looking at the footnote one that you referred us to. As to the legal standard, you quoted Borg Warner Corp versus Flores, and the last sentence of that paragraph, there must be reasonable evidence that the exposure was of sufficient magnitude to exceed the threshold before a likelihood of causation can be inferred. Is that the standard that we should use?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and have a brief recess.